Our meeting of Education Innovation Policy for the last day of January 31, will come to order. Today, members, we have information from the department based on several of their reports. And we are glad that they have taken the time to spend with us this hour and a half or so. Representative Ward, have you reviewed the minutes and would you move approval?
I have, Representative Erickson. Thank you very much. And I move the approval of the minutes from January 26th.
Representative Ward moves approval of the minutes from January 26th. Are there any corrections or additions or discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. I think before we hear from our presenters, because they're still getting a little organized, members, last Thursday I made a mistake in sending those two House files to taxes rather than at the Committee on Education Finance. So I'm going to move to reconsider those two House files. So my first motion is Representative Erickson moves to reconsider House File 387. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. Then I will move that House File 387 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. Is there discussion? I missed the protocol. It's, I guess, always supposed to, in this case, even though it's a tax bill, move to Education Finance first. So all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and House File 387 is re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. I will move to reconsider House File 255. That was the Anderson bill on tax credits and deductions and increasing the amount. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and the House File 255 is reconsidered. Then I will move that House File 255 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Finance. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The motion prevails, and I have completed the protocol. So thank you very much, members, for enduring that. Chairs make mistakes, too, and I just thought they were tax bills, so I sent them to taxes, and the Chair of Education Finance wanted to see them. So welcome, Department of Education. I believe we're going to hear from Greg Keith, who's the Chief Academic Officer at the Department, and from Stephanie Graff, who's the Chief Accountability Officer, on a presentation on the world's best workforce. So welcome to the committee, both of you. Thanks for being here so bright and early. And thank you for the report that you sent out. That was very important for us to review. So, Mr. Keith, are you going to begin? If so, please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, Representatives, I'm Greg Keith. I'm the Chief Academic Officer at the Minnesota Department of Education.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Ms. Graff, do you want to also do
your... Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephanie Graff, Chief Accountability Officer at MDE.
Thank you very much. So whoever's ready to begin, and members, we have a PowerPoint in our packets that we could follow along with. And there may be interruptions with questions as we move along, so don't be surprised.
Thank you.
Please begin.
We're presenting today on World's Best Workforce, some information that you will find in the report that was submitted earlier this month. As you probably know, and as the Commissioner has presented to you previously, World's Best Workforce was passed in legislation in 2013 with the goal that it would be a legislation that would create common goals across the state and would also create the need for districts to have a strategic plan and report on that plan. Under World's Best Workforce, school boards are to develop long-term strategic plans in order to reach five common goals across the state: kindergarten readiness, All students are proficient in reading by third grade or at third grade. All achievement gaps between groups of students are closed. All students graduate from high school, and all students are college ready, college or career ready. And the legislation includes all public school districts as well as charters.
So, Mr. Keith, I have a question, because what you have on the PowerPoint is different from the legislation and from your report. And I just want members to be aware of this, and you may want to just state why you have it explained the way you have on the PowerPoint. The legislation means that under this Section 120B.11, the first goal is meet school readiness. And I see that you have all students ready for kindergarten. And I would question whether your PowerPoint actually is exemplary of what we put in statute, meet school readiness. Would you comment on that, Mr. Keith? Why you've put all students ready for kindergarten rather than setting the goal to meet school readiness?
Madam Chair, typically the way districts work with students is they use kindergarten readiness data in order to measure their progress towards that goal. And so we put that in the PowerPoint to reflect how we advise districts and how districts work towards the goal. They typically see kindergarten as the entry point into the K-12 continuum.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Keith, and I understand that. And I suppose that when you address school districts in saying all, you're really setting a high bar for them, and that's important to us. But it is not what the law says, and that is, I think, a little problematic for me anyway. And on the second point, all third graders proficient in reading. Now, that may be what you think the law says, but have all third graders achieve grade-level literacy. Again, I have a little problem with your verbiage up there. And also on the next, where the legislation said close the achievement gap among all racial and ethnic groups of students, and between students living in poverty and students not living in poverty. It, you know, we did not use the qualifier all. Only on the next two in legislation did we have the words all used, as I recall. And let's see, I did copy the legislation this morning. Yes, the last two are have all students attain career and college readiness before graduating and have all students graduate from high school. So that's just something that maybe you and I need to talk about, because I don't want the public deceived into thinking that on the first point, for example, that we're going to have children at all different levels and that school readiness is so important. But to say that they're all ready for kindergarten, I think, is a great goal, yes, and maybe the way you've worded it is best for districts. But it is not what the legislation says, which to me is a better verbiage, meet school readiness goals rather than they're all ready. Because meeting the goals could be at different levels. So we'll proceed. I just wanted to make that statement before we continue. Please continue with the next slide.
Madam Chair, thank you. So World's Workforce sets out a process that we work with districts around. First of all, school boards are to adopt a comprehensive strategic plan. They have to do that in partnership with an advisory committee. Their plan is to be posted and shared publicly. However, it is not submitted to MDE. They annually also must publish an annual report that reflects on their work from the previous year and updates the community and the strategic plan for moving forward with the next school year. Again, this is not submitted to MDE. It is posted to the district's website. They also have to hold an annual public meeting at which they reflect on the previous year and they share the plan for moving forward. They do develop a brief summary of their annual report. That is submitted to MDE, and it reflects the work of the previous year. So the summaries are submitted to MDE in the fall. This year they were due December 15th from districts. And we have developed and provided a template for districts to use to provide to submit their summaries. All districts use that same template so that there's a standardized system for them to share their information, because we do review the reports in order to provide feedback to districts.
So, Mr. Keith, do we still have 19 districts and two charters having not submitted the summary report as of today?
18 districts. We actually received one yesterday.
Thank you. And two charters.
Two charters.
Thank you, Mr. Keith.
We had received 127 charters on the due date of December 15th. Currently, we have 159 charter reports in. We had received 269 district summaries on the due date of December 15th, and currently 317 are in.
And, Mr. Keith, do you know why there is a delay with some of the districts? Is it just because it's a lot to do?
It varies from district to district. Sometimes it is a lot to do, so sometimes it has to do with workflow. Some districts contacted us and asked that they were able to submit their district summary after a school board meeting, so sometimes their school board schedule might not have accommodated that December 15th deadline. And then there were also several districts where leadership change. Often a new leader might not have been familiar with the process, so we had to work with the school leader or the district leader in order to facilitate the process happening. So on December 15th, we checked which districts, which charters had not submitted plans, and then we followed up with districts and charters in order to assess how we could help them submit their summaries and keep the process moving forward for them.
Very good. Thank you. That's a good process to use. And I'm glad that districts notify you when they have leadership changes or I want to have the school board hear the report. That's very good. Please proceed.
We began reviewing reports on January 4th. We do train reviewers in order to have a standardized process to review the summaries and generate meaningful feedback for districts. We'll send the feedback. Our goal is to send the feedback in March, so reviews will be completed on February 15th. We do review every piece of feedback to ensure that there's some standardized language, to ensure that the feedback is meaningful. And I'll just comment, last year was the first time that we actually had a standardized process with a rubric and a standard template, which added a lot to the review process and the feedback generation process. And this year, as we've worked with districts, as I've worked with districts and Stephanie's worked with districts, they've really communicated how meaningful that feedback was that we generated for them. So, and to have a standard template and to have a rubric that they could base their summaries on. So districts have appreciated some of the supports that we've given them.
Mr. Keith, in the summary report, do districts indicate which of the five goals are maybe their challenges, or if all five goals are their challenges? Do they comment on any of that in the summary?
They don't necessarily comment in that way. They do update their data in terms of what was the progress towards their summaries, and then they do communicate, we feel like we either did not meet this goal or that we met this goal. Or some districts have multi-year goals, and so they also have the option of saying we're making progress towards this goal, or it's not yet a complete goal. Did you want to add anything there?
I would.
Okay.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So we did just want to share that we have 62 MDE staff members, because obviously this is a heavy lift to review all these summaries. So we have 62 trained staff members who are engaging in the review process. Each summary is reviewed by more than one staff member so that we have some good feedback for districts. So we really cast this is an agency-wide effort to review these summaries and generate this feedback. We also have one staff member who coordinates the review process and trains the reviewers and then supports them throughout their process. Obviously, there's a lot of questions that come up since every district has their own context in which they're developing their plan and then their summary. We have two administrative positions that collect and actually track what summaries have been received. They follow up with districts to ensure that they are submitting their summaries. We do have a data analytics team at the department, or at the agency rather, that generate data profiles for districts. And Stephanie's going to talk a little bit more about those data profiles that we provide to districts to inform their planning. And then we also, this is the problem with PowerPoints. The PowerPoint gets ahead of you. And then we have one staff member, Stephanie, who really leads the technical assistance for districts and develops the guidance resource for districts. I do want to say that all of these staff members that I'm talking about, they do this in addition to their designed roles. So Stephanie has a lot of other things she does. She's not just the world's best workforce person. Our data analytics team obviously has a lot of tasks in front of them. So all this is in addition to other job responsibilities and position descriptions.
And I believe Ms. Graff will show us some of those data profiles later.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So I'm going to go ahead, and Madam Chair, if it's okay, we transition
absolutely.
Over to myself. I'm going to dive a little bit into the data and some of the measures that we're seeing being used in the World's Best Workforce. So districts do have the flexibility to establish their World's Best Workforce goals using metrics and benchmarks that really make sense to them at a local level. And so what we're seeing are districts using measures that are meaningful to them, that they own at a local level, that they can mobilize their communities around and their school staff and students around, but not necessarily seeing that all districts are using state measures, which would be primarily made up of MCA results and graduation rates. So we do have both local and state, and I just wanted to make sure that that was kind of clear, that districts are setting their goals using their own local measures, and we're collecting those and providing that feedback, as Greg had mentioned. We're seeing a variety of course, as you would expect, in the quality and kind of the rigor of the goals. Some districts setting expectations that are very high, some not as much. And we're really trying to provide some really good technical assistance around goal setting and how to set what we call SMART goals. So making sure that they're specific and they're strategic in nature, that they're measurable, that we can actually measure progress over time, and that they're not kind of more subjective in nature. They're attainable, right, yet rigorous, so we want to make sure that we're setting ambitious goals, but we want them to be attainable. That's what's going to motivate people to do the work and move forward. We want to make sure they're results-based, so we want to make sure they're based on outcomes of kids and how kids are doing and how kids are improving, and, of course, making sure they're time-bound and time-based, so based on a given timeline, whether that's a one-year or a three-year or potentially a longer-term kind of five-year goal. So really working with districts to provide that technical assistance around how to set SMART goals so that they can really track their progress and communicate with their communities and with us whether they're making whether they're on track to meeting their five goals. We provided this last year, and I thought this was helpful to provide again this year.
Yes.
So we can communicate that we're seeing very different goals across the state, but I think this is a good illustration of the types of goals that we're seeing and the types of information that districts are providing to us. So these are example goals that we actually received this year from districts in the five areas of the world's best workforce. So you can see the broad variety, looking at kindergarten readiness, or Madam Chair, school readiness, as a lot of districts do look at that kindergarten component, using different benchmarks from various assessments that districts use across the state, increasing number of hours in preschool programming, so making sure that kids have more time in pre-K programming. Of course, for third grade reading, some are using MCAs, so you can see one meeting, all kids are meeting proficiency on the MCA. Another one is using the STEP assessment, which is a local assessment that some districts choose to use. Around achievement gap closure, college and career readiness, we probably see the most variety in the types of goals and assessments and measures that districts are using, again, based on meaningful information that they have at the local level and assessments that they have at the local level. And then lastly, graduation as well. So I encourage you to take a peek at some of these just kind of example goals. As Greg did say, these are the goals that we receive. We also receive the results. So a district says, here was our goal for the year. Here's where we are relative to that goal. Did we make it? Did we not make it? Are we close? Are we making progress? And so that's the kind of information that they provide to us.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayes, go ahead.
Sorry, I should speak up. May I ask a question about one of these calls? Thank you. Good morning, Ms. Graff. I have a couple questions about the kindergarten readiness. I was involved in an initiative like this in my district, and this was probably 5 years ago, so maybe things have changed and evolved. But at that time, there wasn't a state standard around kindergarten readiness, and I'd like you to speak to that. We chose the KSEP tool, which was out of California at the time, and I believe Utah was using it as well. And it was the process to decide what is K-ready when you're looking at cognitive or academic, but also social, emotional, and even physical, playful readiness, all those different components. So how do you direct districts right now? Do you have a standard? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to have Greg Keith speak to that. He does oversee our early learning division.
Thank you.
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, what we have done in terms of kindergarten readiness measures for districts, under our Race to the Top grant, we did look at 8 assessments for districts, and we looked at them in terms of how aligned they were to Minnesota's standards for early childhood. All of the tools that we looked at are designed to measure children's cognitive, social, emotional, language, literacy, and physical development. Through that work, we identified 4 of those 8 assessments that were aligned to Minnesota standards. Currently, we are benchmarking those 4 assessments so that a district can either look across assessments or use one of those assessments to say this student is kindergarten ready. So we provide those 4 assessments that districts can choose to use. However, they can choose whatever local measure they'd like to choose. But we do provide those 4 for districts. We do also provide regional training. We have a train-the-trainer model. We have a cohort of trainers for each of the 4 assessments. So we can also provide for districts trainings to support their use of those assessments.
Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And another question. Are any part of those assessments helping districts pull in feedback from daycare, preschool, even parents, and the transition from, you know, that age group learning into kindergarten? What we found is even sharing with those other providers what was expected for K-readiness helped them enhance their programming for their 3- and 4-year-olds so that you were sort of getting people talking the same language and trying to move kids, you know, along a continuum that had a stated goal. Any work being done there?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative. Primarily we do that through the use of a common set of early childhood standards. So we find the language and the conversation about what the common outcomes and expectations are for programs in early childhood to be standards-based. And then the assessments are actually a reflection of those standards. So we do communicate that through a use of a common set of early childhood standards.
And, Mr. Keith, I have in my hands your October 2016 publication where you separate voluntary pre-K program standards from Head Start. And members, this is accessible on their website. And if you read through it, you will notice that I think you have set down at least a dozen standards for the pre-K kindergarten program. Yes. Mm-hmm. For the voluntary pre-K. No. Yes, there are 12. And then Head Start has many more, but is that because of federal regulations, Mr. Keith?
I don't know the answer to that question. However, I can follow up with our early childhood program staff. And I can send that information.
So then the question that Representative Haley, or the comment she just made about making sure that our private pre-K programs have access to this, is that happening? I mean, she said they were sharing it. I believe you were saying that in your district. But do you know, or Ms. Graff, if that's happening across the state?
Madam Chair, right, I think this is likely a question that would be best addressed from our Director of Early Learning, Bobby Burnham. Yeah, and so I wouldn't want to speak here on the record today without having full information from that division.
Thank you. Maybe that will occur in our Early Childhood Committee.
It may.
So
it may.
Thank you. Another question? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask an early childhood question, but if we're going to be specifically dealing with early childhood at a different time, I will wait for that. But I would like to go back for just a minute. You had talked about on the process for World Workforce, the annual public meeting. Is that separate from a school board's annual meeting that would also be public? So are they having two meetings like this to cover the year?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, it really depends on the local district. Some of them hold the annual meeting in conjunction with a school board meeting or as part of the agenda of a school board meeting, and some districts do have it as a separate public meeting.
Okay, thank you. And one other question, if I may.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clarify your comment on slide 5 about the staffing levels at MDE. Am I understanding that when we implemented this in 2013, no additional staff was added to take care of this? Is that correct?
Mr. Keith.
Madam Chair, Representative, no additional staff was added to MDE.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Please continue.
As Greg had mentioned, we do on an annual basis release World's Best Workforce data profiles to all districts and charter schools in the state. This uses data not necessarily that districts have in their use in their goal setting at the local level, but state-level measures, primarily MCA results and graduation rates, and runs that sort of in the five areas of the world's best workforce. And we release this publicly on our website, and we send this directly to all superintendents and charter directors. This year it went out in October. Actually, last year it went out in October as well. There are nine data profiles that are released, and they're released based on the nine service cooperative regions across the state. And districts really like this. They like to see regional level data to say, well, first, how are we doing in the Northwest compared to, you know, for our example, just as an example, American Indian students compared to a region in the Northeast, maybe around third grade reading or around closing some achievement gaps across math and reading. And they also like to say, how am I doing compared to the district next to me and my neighboring district in different areas as well. And so we've heard really great feedback about being very transparent with the state-level measures that we have in the five areas of World's Best Workforce and allowing them to do some district-by-district and region-by-region comparisons across the state. I've provided the URL to the data profiles that are up on our website. They're nine Excel spreadsheets. They are fairly large because there is a lot of data here. There's a lot to share and a lot to look at. And then the EXU regions, which actually they're at that URL, but they're provided here for you as well. And so so we do have those data profiles available for districts to use. I'll take a minute just to talk through, and Madam Chair, I did not bring an actual data profile here today to show to the committee. Would be happy to provide that at a later time if that's of interest to members. But here is the information that we do have in the data profiles. So for our first goal of World's Best Workforce, as Greg has talked about, we do not have an assessment that we collect the results for at the state level. Some districts are using one of the four options, the four optional assessments that we have available, but really district, you know, we don't have any state-level data that's comparable and standardized across the state for that first goal of World's Best Workforce. Around third-grade literacy, we're providing them with, as you may be familiar with, we have a kind of two primary goals in the state that you see woven throughout these data profiles. One is to close the gap by 50% by 2017, And one is to reach a 90% graduation rate for all students with no student group below 85% by the year 2020. And so what we've done is we've provided districts with how they're doing relative to the kind of broad achievement gap and graduation goals. So third grade reading, we're telling them where they are in 2016 relative to the 2016 goal. Are they moving in the direction to meet that goal? Also looking at third grade reading as, you know, are you proficient in third grade, but also using that as a springboard for acceleration and growth moving into fourth grade. So we do provide them with some growth data as well at a fourth grade level. Achievement gaps, how are they doing in math and reading to reduce the gap by 2017, telling them they met their individual targets in 2016. All students college and career ready. As I mentioned before, districts are using a broad variety of measures in their college and career readiness area of World's Best Workforce. What we're providing to districts is grade 8 math proficiency results for a few different reasons. First, grade 8 math is strongly performance on the grade 8 math assessment is strongly predictive of performance on the ACT. Some do view maybe grade 8 as kind of a gateway for high school programming in high school, so it's actionable for districts. And then lastly, it's what we have that includes all students across the state, or most students across the state, and is data that every district has available. So we're looking at grade 8 math proficiency. Again, districts use a broad variety of measures for their own local goal setting. Lastly, graduation rates. We're providing them with their 2015 graduation rates. New graduation rates will be released within a month. And so, as some of you may know, graduation rates, there's always a one-year lag in the release of graduation rates. So you can expect to see 2016 graduation rates released, again, within about a month or so. And then lastly, this was a new component that was added this year, framed equitable access to excellent teachers. And what we're providing them is with their most recent 2016 data on the percent of inexperienced teachers and percent of classes taught by unqualified or out-of-field teachers. Some of you may be familiar with our federal teacher equity plan that all states had to do a couple years ago and is now kind of continued under the new Every Student Succeeds Act. And this was added to the World's Best Workforce legislation last year, that all districts are reviewing their data to ensure across the state that low-income and minority students are not disproportionately taught by inexperienced and unqualified teachers. And so this is asking for them to look at that state-level data, and we do ask for a little bit of information about that data review process in their summaries as well. So that is a new component of the World's Best Workforce.
So, Ms. Graff, I would still like to see the department change that first heading, because meet school readiness goals is throughout your report and it's in the law, and I think we're misleading when we say all students ready for kindergarten when we're really trying to focus on that readiness piece. So I would like you to consider that. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to understand maybe a different way of saying those words, is unqualified, is it someone that's not licensed and perhaps have a problem with the licensing procedure that we have right now, or that they just don't, they're in the classroom and they really don't have the qualifications to teach?
Ms. Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you. We did go through an extensive process with external stakeholders around how we would define unqualified and out-of-field and inexperienced. And right now, unqualified is not licensed in the content area in which they are teaching.
Representative Haley, did you have a question in regard to this?
Yes, thank you. Can you speak to the math goal a little bit? I know that's a difficult one. You had to pick one for readiness, but I kind of struggle with eighth grade math as one data point indicating college and career readiness. We all know, 70% of jobs by 2020 are going to require post-secondary, but post-secondary can mean different things, from two-year to certificate to four-year. And if we're aligning eighth grade math as an ACT indicator, it's narrow to me. And I wonder if I've gotten feedback from districts on that goal.
Madam Chair, Representative, absolutely. And we are districts, again, I would say most of them are not using grade 8 math as their measure for establishing their goal and tracking their progress around college and career readiness. I think they're using a menu of other types of measures and assessments. We realize this is an imperfect measure, and we've communicated that with districts. We would like to add to our college and career readiness measures. What we want to make sure that, and so maybe we're providing additional data points around college and career readiness to districts. What we want to make sure is that this is inclusive of all kids, and that it's standardized across the state, and that every district has the same measure. And so ACT, for example, we could add that here. Not all kids take the ACT, and so we've chosen at this point to stick with the measure that is inclusive of all, knowing that moving forward, and there is some work around defining college and career readiness better and having some better measures in that area, we would like to add to this. So I would echo your comments, and I think districts would as well, and certainly an area that we're working on.
Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. And I have another question regarding all these goals. So I talked a little bit about the K readiness and now, you know, 8th grade math. What is the mechanism for districts to share or for you to share with them best practices and how this gets implemented in a school with the kids? Because we can all look at data points and submit them and look at a data profile, but the picture is so much larger. And what is the department doing to actually share the stories on the feet on the ground and what's really working and what's not working?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. We are going to dive into that. We did conduct some focus groups last year, and so Greg Heath will be talking about that in a minute, exactly what you're talking about, learning best practices and supporting districts in networking. And so in just a few minutes, we'll touch on that.
Thank you.
There it is.
When we look at your website, though, on the data points, it will be the indicator will be 8th grade math, right, as you know, when we go to this website for the World's Best Workforce data profiles, you will be using 8th grade math for those data points, correct?
Madam Chair,
when we look at districts.
That is correct, yes.
Please proceed.
We were interested in how we could better support districts in their World's Best Workforce work, so we conducted 7 focus groups across the state. We did this in partnership with the Regional Educational Laboratory, so they actually facilitated the focus groups based on our needs, so it was an external facilitation process. In those focus groups, we had superintendents, principals, teachers, data coordinators, and other district administrators. And really our goal in focus group was to collect what are successes the districts are experiencing, what barriers are they experiencing, and what we could do to better assist districts with their World's Best Workforce processes. So some of the successes that emerged or themes that emerged were the 5 that you see on this slide. And we really saw a lot of the successes that districts communicated that engaging in the World's Best Workforce process had created opportunities for partnership or enhanced opportunities for partnership and enhanced opportunities and reasons to engage with their communities, be that businesses, be that parents, be that other community organizations. Also coordination and alignment of activities was a theme that emerged in terms of successes. So many districts that already had initiatives operating or had strategic plans used the World's Best Workforce planning process to create alignment between district initiatives and create a common district focus around one plan and around a common set of goals. And then also it's increased their knowledge of using assessment and using data to drive that planning process. It's interesting that when we look at challenges, the use of data also emerges as not only a success but also a challenge. So some of the challenges that districts communicated or themes in the challenges that districts communicated are use of data, choosing appropriate assessments to measure their progress towards World's Best Workforce and to set goals. And then also they struggle with providing enough professional development and enough support to teachers to actually support the implementation of their World's Best Workforce plan. And that's for a number of reasons. Many times it's resources, many times it's focus. So some of the things that they shared that we could do to better support them and some of our current priorities in terms of supporting districts around World's Best Workforce, we echoed, and Stephanie's talked about this a little bit, about the measures for career and college readiness. One of the initiatives we're currently doing with the Midwest Comprehensive Center is to offer districts, based on the definition of career and college readiness in statute, what are some appropriate measures for career and college readiness, and how would you use those measures, and then resources that would assist districts with using those measures, using the data from those measures in order to incorporate career and college readiness better into their overall strategic plan. We are also doing a lot of work right now with how can districts be networked. This was a very specific request from districts. How can we create networking opportunities for districts to get together and talk about what's working, what's not working, what supports have worked in one district versus what barriers is another district experiencing. So districts are asking for opportunities to network together. And we're primarily kicking that work off and doing that work through our regional centers of excellence. So this would be a regional-based opportunity for districts to work together and share successes and work through challenges together.
Mr. Keith, when districts submit these summaries, do they, in any of the narrative, note the number of students taking, for example, concurrent enrollment, advanced placement, could be international baccalaureate, it could be PSEO, because, you know, being able to take a college course at the high school level is certainly going to be some kind of indicator for being ready for college, and I'd say for career, too. So do they indicate that in their summary that they submit?
Madam Chair, they would indicate that if that was one of their specific goals or if that was their, if they were using that measure in order to track their progress according to their local goal. So we do not specifically ask for that specific information unless it's aligned with their local goal.
And, Mr. Keith, do you recall if some are including that? Ms. Graff, you're shaking your head.
Madam Chair, absolutely. I'd say that's the most common. If I were to just in looking at the summaries, I think that is the most common measure that districts are using, wanting to increase participation in AP and IB, concurrent enrollment, PSEO, and also wanting to reduce gaps in the types of students that are involved in those opportunities as well. And so that is it's a common area that we're seeing.
And I'm sure because we have the most robust math standards in the nation, but that's why the indicator is eighth grade math. I think that's probably a pretty conclusive decision by the department because we do have the most robust math standards in the nation. Thank you very much. Are there other questions? Representative May Quaid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to just go back to the seven focus groups. So we've got superintendents, principals, teachers. I know that we have a shortage of teachers of color. I would assume that that extends into superintendents, principals, and district administrators. So when we had these seven groups, how many actual people of color were at the table when we're talking about closing the achievement gap?
Ms. Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think that's an excellent point. As Greg had talked about, we did have Midwest Well, an external kind of unbiased organization facilitate these. We were not in the room for these, so I don't even know the names or the faces behind these participants. That was intentional. We didn't want MDE to be facilitating. We wanted to step outside the room so they could have very candid conversations. So I can't answer that question clearly, but I do think that's just an important point to make, that we're always aware of that and making sure that we do have people of color represented on these types of committees and opportunities.
Representative Kunish Padin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back on slide 12, you're talking about increasing the knowledge of the assessment options. Can you share with us what some of those options are and how a district chooses which assessments they're going to use? Are we comparing apples to oranges, or how does that look?
Ms. Graff.
Madam Chair, Representative, There are so many options for districts to look at their needs and determine the types of assessments that they want to purchase and use to measure student progress. And so we should actually do this at some point. We have not totaled up the number of assessments that districts are using in their World's Best Workforce goals, but I would say it's very high. So I don't have that list, but what they're doing is they're looking at their needs, they're looking at the grade levels, and they're looking at specifically what do we want to track, what do we want to measure, and determining an assessment that may meet their needs. Again, they're not all aligned with our state standards. They're not all the math or reading MCA, but there are other assessments that are locally designed or purchased at the local level for use. And so that just looks so different across the state. I do think that's something that districts would like to network on. Mm-hmm. And talk with each other on what is working for you. How long have you used it? Have you seen improvements? Is this informing instruction in the classroom? Is this helpful for educators, for our teachers? And so something that I think we're really interested in bringing districts together to talk more about.
One more question. And then how does this assessment or the reports take into consideration students with special ed requirements or special needs? Are they included in there? Are they part of the long-term information?
Ms. Graff. Madam Chair, Representative, they're absolutely included. If they're not included, we encourage districts to include them and ask for them to include them. Around the achievement gap goal is an area where we oftentimes see goals for districts that they would like to reduce gaps for their students with disabilities and their students that don't have disabilities. That's a common area where we're seeing some really targeted goals in math and reading. We're also seeing some districts providing, not all, but some districts providing strategies that they're using with their students with disabilities in their summaries, but that's not across the board. But really in the goal areas, we're seeing more and more districts setting those goals for students with disabilities. It's also included in the data profiles. So when we look at third grade reading, when we look at math and reading achievement gap, when we look at the college and career readiness and graduation, we're very transparent with how our students with disabilities are doing in those areas and whether we're meeting the mark or making progress towards our goals.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And members, we will have a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on testing sometime in the future. And at that point, I think it will be important to step into the arena that Ms. Graff noted, all the different assessments that are used in districts. Thank you. So thank you very much, both of you. Any closing comment? Just that you're a resource.
Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, Representative Pryor, did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
Just very quickly, going back to the idea of the focus group and how representational it was, it seems like when it's set up in the future to make sure that you are including people of color so that we can look at the equity issues too.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Pryor. I know that when I have attended various meetings, we've had good representation from most racial most ethnic groups, so I think they're very aware of that. Dr. Melcher. Members, next we're going to go to a presentation of the Department's Special Education Statewide Average Expenditure, and again, a report was recently released, and you also have a folder with information in it. And again, I could call your attention to a 2013 Office of the Legislative Report on Special Education if you want to dig in deeper to information that the audit report reveals, some of which we've worked on in this legislature. Welcome, Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Director of the School Finance Division at the Department of Education. Also with me is Paul Farron. Paul is the supervisor of our special education funding and data team, and he did most of the detail work on this report. And if you have questions that go into the special education programs, we also have Robin Woodley and others here who could help answer those questions. The requirement for this report was established by the 2013 legislature when the legislature changed the funding mechanism for special education. Traditionally, Minnesota has funded special education costs on a straight reimbursement type model where we fund a percentage of the salaries and other expenses for special education. In 2013, the legislature decided to add a component to the funding formula based on a student-based approach to funding. We still primarily fund based on a reimbursement basis, but we do now include a portion of the formula that's based on the cost per special education student. And so when that was enacted, it was felt that it was important for us to keep tabs on where we're at in terms of the cost per student by disability area as general information to the legislature, and also to provide a sense of whether we're on track in terms of the funding that we're allocating on that basis. So I apologize, I don't have a PowerPoint prepared for this. Unfortunately, the kind of data I have is all like small numbers, and so it didn't seem to fit well with a PowerPoint. So I'm assuming that you have a copy of the report, and I'm going to walk you through some of the pages there. So on page,
you have the report.
So, Madam Chair and members, on, starting on the bottom of page 4, we have a listing of the primary disabilities for special education. When school districts report their data on special education to the department, the expenditures are broken down by primary disability areas. And we have information reported on our UFARS, Uniform Financial Accounting and Reporting System, that identifies what the expenditures are for each disability area. And we also have data coming in through our MARS system, which is our student accounting system, to identify how many students are being served in each disability area. So we have pretty good information on how many students are served in each area and what the cost is that's reported for those areas. What the new funding formula does that takes effect in the 2015-2016 school year, so we've just finished the first year and we're into the middle of the second year now, it rank orders the different primary disability areas in terms of the cost per student, and it provides more funding for disability areas that have higher costs per pupil on the average. So if you turn to page 7 of the report, there's a little summary chart, and what this does is it identifies the number of students, the 2016 child count in each disability area. And I apologize, we didn't have room on the page so you have to kind of flip back to the previous page to see what the category is. So, for example, disability area 403 is developmental cognitive disabilities, severe or profound. That's the most expensive area. On a per-child basis, there were 1,997 students counted on the December 1st, 2015 count. School districts reported $96 million in cost for those categories. In addition to the cost that's reported directly in individual special education categories, we also have a UFARS code. It's code 420. You see it at the bottom of the table. There was $292 million reported in kind of district-wide costs, and those are costs for programs that serve students with three or more primary disabilities. So, for example, that's where the special education director's costs would be, other costs that need to be spread across categories. So in order to estimate the cost of serving students with disabilities, we take the cost that's directly charged. That would be, for example, for teachers that are working specifically with that disability. And then we add this allocated cost. So for this particular category, we had $96 million of direct cost, and then $4 million that was allocated for indirect costs that couldn't be directly charged to a disability. And when you divide that by the number of students, you come up with an average cost statewide of about $50,624 per student for that particular category. And so we do the same sort of calculation for each primary disability area and come up with an average cost for each of those areas. So the highest was the developmental cognitive disabilities, severe or profound. The very lowest at the bottom of the table, 410, is other health disabilities. And the average cost per student for that category was $6,436. Part of the reason for doing this cost report annually is that when we went to a student-driven funding formula in part, we had been collecting this data for quite a few years, but we had never used it in the funding process. So there was an expectation that when districts realize we're using it for funding, they're going to be a little bit more careful in how they account for the cost and make sure they get it in the right bucket, and the legislature might want to come back at some point and readjust, you know, which categories are considered high cost versus moderate cost versus lower cost categories. So the way that the original legislation was structured, if you actually turn back to page 5, you'll see the statute that refers to this program, and it might be easiest if we start at the bottom of the page there, and you'll see that what the formula does is it funds programs that are in the highest cost category at $27,000 per child per year, and that includes the developmental cognitive mild moderate, developmental cognitive severe profound, physically impaired, visually impaired, and deaf blind. Those were the categories that had the highest average cost per student in 2013 when the formula was established, and so they were lumped into this category. We calculated this average cost per student. The next category down was funded at $18,000, and that was primary disability areas of deaf and hard of hearing and emotional or behavioral disorders. And then the next category down was autism, spectrum disorders, developmental delay, and severely multiply impaired. So those three groups all have a certain rate per child count. Mm-hmm. And then what the legislation also did is it took the other lower cost categories, for example, speech impaired and other health disabilities, and instead of funding those on a direct rate per child, what the legislature did was established a funding formula that's based on the total number of students in the district. And so what the funding work, how that funding works is we provide $450 per average daily membership for all of the students in the district, plus $400 times the percentage of students that are free and reduced lunch. So if 50% of the students were free and reduced lunch, the district would get another $200. And it's been documented that we have higher concentrations of special education students in high poverty areas. And then the third one is there's a small factor applied to the overall district size. And this part of the formula is very similar to the federal formula for special education, where most of the money for federal funding goes out based on the total enrollment in the state and in the school district. And also there's a factor for poverty. The federal government switched back around 18 years ago to what we call a census-based formula. It's more consistent with what we do in the general education program, for example, where we fund based on the number of students in the district. So at this point in time, what we've done is we've taken the cost by disability, and then on page 8, we summarize that down into these four funding levels that were established in the law. And what we're doing with the report is trying to gauge whether, you know, are we still on track in terms of, you know, is the funding formula reflecting what the differences are in the average cost. So over on the left-hand column here, you can see funding levels 1 through 4, with level 1 being the lowest cost on the average and level 4 being the highest cost. So you can see the average funding amount by category. And then over on the right-hand side, you can see the average cost by funding category. And as you can see, there's still a pretty good correlation between the average cost by funding category and the average funding level. But there are some adjustments that could be made to better align the funding rates with the average costs by category. For example, you can see that after we worked through that pupil-driven formula, that the average funding amount is about $8,200, the average cost is about $8,600, So we're a little bit low in that area. The same level two is especially low, 10,000 versus 13,000. And then we're much closer for levels three and four. And so what Table 4 does is it offers some suggestions to the legislature on how those statutory factors could be amended to reflect the most current data. And it suggests that the rate that is currently set at 10,400, if you wanted to reflect the most current data, we would be adjusting that to 12,700. The 18,000 would be adjusted to 19,000, and the 27,000 would be adjusted to 27,200. So there are some adjustments that could be made if we wanted to better align the funding with the cost levels. And the same would be true of these per pupil amounts. So, for example, the 450 would be adjusted to 467. So this is just provided in the interest of keeping you up to date on how the cost of special education is comparing with the amounts that were set in law a couple of years ago. One thing I will say is that part of the governor's recommendation for special education funding does pick up the changes that are included in this report. It would increase the cost of special education aid by roughly $2 million a year if these kinds of adjustments were made in the funding mechanism. So that's a very quick run-through, Madam Chair, and Mr. Farron is here and is able to answer any more detailed questions that you might have, or if you have questions about some of the disability areas and want to have further information on those and why the costs might be varying, either Mr. Farron or Robin Woodley from our Special Education Department could respond to that.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. And on page 9 is the proposed language that the commissioner will bring forward. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and members, yes, that will be included in the governor's bill.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Erdahl has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Bill, this is for Dr. Melcher or Mr. Perrin. Of the dollars spent for special education in Minnesota, you know what percent comes from the federal government?
Madam Chair and Representative Erdahl, that reminds me that there was another document that was included in your packet that is not part of this report, but it's a separate report, and I think members should have a copy of that. So currently, the this report just shows the Part B Section 611 funding, which is the primary federal special education aid that flows out to school districts. We're currently receiving about $194 million. The cost of special education is roughly, I think, around $2.4 billion. So the federal contribution is relatively small. And just to give you a little history about this report, back in the mid-70s, when the federal government created the federal mandate for special education, wrote the federal special education law, the goal for federal funding at the time was to cover 40% of the nationwide average excess cost for special education. And we've kept track of that over the years. The federal government has never come anywhere close to the 40% level. And so for the current year, 16-17, if we were to receive the funding at the 40% level, it would be about $606 million. We're currently receiving $193 million, so they're covering about 13% of the average level, which is lower than the Minnesota level. So currently, the federal government, by our calculations, is about $412 million short of funding what their goal was from the 70s.
Okay, thank you.
Dr. Melcher, Mr. Heller has a question in regard to the funding code. Where would we find the twice exceptional listed in the, or Mr. Farron, maybe you can answer that?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand what twice exceptional.
The print disabled.
I'm sorry, what?
The print disabled.
Print disabled.
120B.15 is the statute he references.
We're going to bring Ms. Woodley up.
Also, please say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Robin Woodley, and I'm the Director of Special Education at the Department of Education. As I understand, twice exceptional is a is an area where a child may be disabled as well as be academically gifted. And within that, I'm not aware that we have any categories that are in this funding formula.
Thank you. And perhaps Mr. Heller could address you with that question.
Thank you.
Thank
you
very
much.
Representative May Quaid, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This might be to the folks up here, but it actually might be to the Chair. Have we ever lobbied our members of Congress or the federal government to get our funding for special education? This is something I do hear a lot about in the district, and particularly from G&T and special ed parents feel like their children are being pitted against each other. Have we ever coordinated like a 50-state strategy to get our funding? I'm not sure what has been done in the past.
Well, when Representative May Quaid, when Representative Klein was chair of Labor and Education, he heard from me probably every other week. So I'm sure if he heard from me, he was hearing from other members too, pleading that the federal government consider increasing its full funding level closer to 40% than it presently is. Thank you to both of you. Dr. Melcher, or Mr. Ferry maybe could answer this. I was reading the litigation report that I just received, noting that we had some high litigation costs. Maybe this is not unusual. $273,952.23 were litigation costs. Could you just comment on that report, or whoever could just comment on that report? Just whether or not this is usual or was this exceptional, please say your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Mary Kay Kanega-Litza. I'm the Director of Compliance and Assistance.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I can speak in general as to what the
Certainly.
Types of litigation costs that we have. Litigation costs can be included with there have been some lawsuits, and so the regarding different areas, and if they have a piece of special education that would be covered. If we have a complaint that is appealed to the Court of Appeals, if there is a due process hearing and we need to have the Attorney General do some work on that regarding appeal as well. We had some student maltreatment issues as well, and if they involve a student with a disability, that would also be involved in the litigation costs.
Thank you very much for that clarification. Members, you might want to go to the website of the department if you have not received this special education litigation costs for fiscal 2017 and just review that, because it also tells us that that is another area for which we provide funding. Dr. Melcher.
Madam Chair, if I could just add one comment. I think Ms. Litzau was referring to some of the litigation costs that the department is involved with, and the report I think that you are referring to is a report from the school districts that are required to annually report to the department on litigation costs that they incur as school districts over those similar kinds of issues.
So, Dr. Melcher, is there a separate place where the department indicates what it's cost the department?
Madam Chair, the report that we produce to the legislature annually is a report from the school districts, what their expenditures are, and we pull that from the UFARS reporting. There are some costs the department may have involved as well.
Thank you. Welcome. Say your name for the record.
Madam Chair, Darren Cordy. I'm an assistant commissioner at the Department of Education. First, I'd like to say I'm happy to be back in front of your committee, Madam Chair. We do track those expenditures. It's not something that is included in a report to the legislature, but certainly if that was something that the legislature was interested in taking a look at, that's all public data that can be provided to you.
Thank you very much. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you indicated before that maybe you could speak a little bit more about what might be driving these costs to increase more in an unexpected way, especially relative to other, you know, within the categories, how some costs seem to be rising faster than others or more than others. Is that the case?
Mr. Perrin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Districts basically, so there is this They're going to report costs in our, we have an electronic data reporting system. That's where we're going to further request them to report their costs. So not only is it sitting in their UFARs, financial actual accounting, which is tied to their checkbook, they have to report to us in our electronic data reporting system, EDRS. This allows us, they have to specifically give us the actual teacher's or the service provider's name along with the file folder number, which we can then tie back to verify their license to that disability. A problem that I know we generally have with some of the lower, with the, specifically the traumatic brain injury being one of the lower of the average costs, is there is no specific license there, and so districts on average seem to just, they don't report costs there, and instead the students are receiving services from other licensed areas, the speech pathologists and just other physically impaired and other groups, but they're reporting the cost of that individual solely based on just their license. We do a lot of training and instructing, and we provide reports showing what their unreimbursed rates are for tuition billing to then help them to, you know, you have students you're reporting here. They are, you know, specifically with these traumatic brain or the deafblind, and the instructions are generally, you know, look to see who your students are in the districts. Most have, you know, fewer than a handful at best, or even with the deafblind, maybe just one at best. And seeing then who does work with that student and then making sure that they're allocating part of their salary to that disability.
Welcome. Say your name again, and would you spell?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair. My name is Robin Widley, R-O-B-Y-N, and W-I-D-L-E-Y. And once again, I'm the Director of Special Education at the Department. As I was looking at a couple pieces of data that Tom Melcher just gave me, as we think about a couple of the categories, especially in the area of developmentally delayed, which is a category for children ages 3 through 7 who are disabled, that number has really increased due to the significant efforts of local districts and their county agencies in terms of identifying kids who have special needs. So we're real proud of that. And in addition, there's another category that's increased that has some cost factor to it, and that would be kids that are severely multiply impaired, meaning having more than one disability, and those children generally have some high costs in terms of services. I also would say to the committee that we do have an increase in children in our child count that we take every year for kids that are on IEPs, ages birth to 21. Once again, we are a state that provides special education down to birth. We're one of the few states in the country that does that. And our current numbers of children ages birth to 21 who are on IEPs and receiving special education in our state is 137,601, which is 15.7% of the population of kids who are enrolled in school. And of that, children ages 6 through 21 represent 13.5% of the population of students who are in the, who are receiving special education in comparison to their general education peers. So that gives a little bit of a context, if you will, for the numbers.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. Melcher, Mr. Farron, and everyone who's assisted in this presentation on special education. Very much appreciated. With that, we'll move to our last topic, Reading Well by Third Grade. Beth Ani and Corey Stay. And members, you do have a folder on this as well. Entitled Student Performance Traits. Thank you. Welcome to both of you. Nice to see you, Ms. Ani. I haven't seen you for a long time.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. We're sharing some information this morning on reading well by third grade. I'm Beth Downey, Director of the Division of Academic Standards and Instructional Effectiveness, and with me today is Corey Stye, who is our reading specialist. Today we're going to be sharing information about student performance in reading. We'll do that rather quickly, and then talk about state policies related to reading, how those policies are being implemented, and then some current efforts at MDE related to reading achievement. So first, let's look overall at some student performance trends. The first thing I should note is that we did adopt new English language arts standards, including reading standards, in 2013. So we shouldn't make comparisons in reading from 2012 to 2013. The MCA reading data for all grades reveals that across the years, Minnesota has seen consistent and incremental growth in reading proficiency overall. However, this growth has been slow. Minnesota has also seen consistent and incremental growth in reading proficiency for all students, for all student racial and ethnic groups, and this reflects efforts to close achievement gaps. If we look at some national data, the most recent scores on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is given at grades 4, 8, and 12, shows that at grade 4, Minnesota continues to perform above the national average. Those numbers have followed a similar trend in grade 3 until last year when we saw a drop in scores for the first time. When we zero in just on the third grade data, we see similar trends by racial and ethnic groups to overall performance across the tested grades. And this trend continues for other student groups as well, free and reduced price lunch, special education, migrant status, and English learners. And now we have baseline data for another student group, homeless students. So that's a very quick look at proficiency overall. I know you've seen these kinds of data before. So let's look at some key policies related to reading achievement that we have in our state. The first one that we look at is commonly referred to as the Read Well legislation. This really began in 2001 with the passage of the Reading Intervention Law. In 2011, it became titled Reading Proficiently No Later Than the End of Grade 3. And at that point, the requirement for a local literacy plan was added. There are five major components to this Read Well legislation. First, districts are required to assess students' reading proficiency using locally determined assessments and identify students who need intervention in order to accelerate their learning so that they're on track to be reading well by the end of grade 3. A second component requires districts to annually, at least, notify parents if their child is reading below grade level, inform them of the interventions that are being provided, and share ways that they can support their child's literacy development at home, including in their native language, if that's appropriate. Districts are always also required to provide appropriate interventions to meet the identified needs of their students. Finally, districts must provide professional development to staff to ensure that they can deliver comprehensive, scientifically based reading instruction and deliver the interventions as intended. And then districts must also report a summary of their data and submit their local literacy plan to the department by July 1st of each year. A second important policy is literacy incentive aid. Districts receive funding based on two measures, proficiency aid and growth aid. Proficiency aid is determined by the percentage of grade 3 students who are meeting or exceeding the standards on the MCA reading. And growth aid is determined by the percentage of fourth grade students meeting their growth target from the third grade MCA to the fourth grade MCA. Literacy incentive aid does not have to be used for literacy or reading programs. It can be used for any purpose. There are a number of other literacy initiatives that we have in our state that are funded. One is the Minnesota Reading Corps. This provides school-based tutors who work with identified struggling readers one-on-one to provide evidence-based literacy interventions. A second initiative funded by the state is the singing-based reading program pilot, which provides funding to the Rock and Read program, which uses a karaoke style of singing or repeated reading that's highly motivating to students. Something else that's been added to state policy are two definitions that relate to reading. There's a definition of comprehensive, scientifically-based reading instruction, which was revised in 2011, and then a definition for dyslexia was added in 2015. So those are some of the largest policies related to reading in our state. How are we doing in terms of implementing the reading standards and policies? We can look to at least three sources of information to answer that question, and we'll review each of these in the upcoming slides. But we get a number of interesting findings from the data from these three sources. The first source is the 2016 English Language Arts Multi-Tiered Systems of Support Implementation Survey. This measures school-wide implementation of the core features of multi-tiered systems of support within the context of the English Language Arts standards. And there are a number of items on the MTSS Survey 12 that specifically address the important work related to standards implementation. And when we look at how districts respond to those items specifically, we find that only 19% of elementary schools, 13% of middle schools, and 9% of high schools rate a majority of those items at being at full implementation. Another way to look at this is of those schools taking the survey in both of the last 2 years, only 17% of schools are at full implementation of the ELA standards. Now, what do we mean by full implementation? Full implementation means that there's a very deep understanding of what the standards mean, the rigor involved in the standards, and that there's refined ongoing use of data and effective practices to implement those standards. When there's full implementation, districts are providing ongoing training and support and coaching to prevent erosion or backslide and to promote implementation that is sustained across time. So what have we seen in terms of some challenges? Well, indeed, we are finding that the progress is slow with implementation. Implementation, as implementation science informs us, takes indeed a very long time. And we have seen some backslide and some challenges with sustaining implementation over time. And there are at least four key things that we've discovered in the data from the survey. First, over 40% of key leaders in these schools changed between 2015 and 2016. So staff turnover and leadership is a major component here. A second challenge is that when districts need to adopt new standards, new curriculum, or new practices, this impedes, or it can impede, their implementation progress. And I think the legislature took note of this when it decided to adopt a 10-year standards review cycle instead of the shorter one that had been in effect, because they understand that it takes a lot of time to implement these things. Third, districts and schools are often implementing multiple initiatives at once, so that makes their capacity spread thinly over many different tasks and initiatives. And finally, continuous improvement processes often uncover the need to revisit work or some assumptions they may have assumed that were untrue that they need to address. This year we found that for the first time there is a weak but positive correlation that shows reading proficiency and implementation of the standards makes a difference. Schools that had an average fully implemented response on the MTSS survey had an average of 5% more students who scored proficient on reading than did the schools who rated themselves at an earlier stage of implementation. Another data source that we look to for information about how well we are or are not implementing reading policies is the local literacy plan analysis. MDE worked with Hanover Research to conduct an analysis of 50 sample literacy plans from districts, and we had they uncovered a number of interesting findings. For example, over 84% of districts' plans met 50% or more of the required components of the Read Well legislation. However, only 24% of districts met 70% or more of those components. So basically, districts are struggling to keep up with the many changes that have occurred in this law. And we also see a lag in implementation as capacity is continually built up at all levels of the state system. Another source that we look at for information about implementation is the Read Well data submission process. Reporting has revealed several challenges with local assessment and data literacy. For example, assessments have been reported as measuring reading components that they don't assess. For example, a school might report that a letter naming assessment is measuring phonemic awareness. Another thing we see happening is that multiple schools using the same assessment at the same grade level report very different cut scores for grade level proficiency. So there is confusion or at least lack of agreement across the board as to what constitutes proficiency. A third thing we see is that some assessments are being used for purposes that the publishers do not claim are valid. For example, they might be using the NWEA's MAP test for progress monitoring, which is something that the test, the assessment is not designed or validated to do. And finally, we're seeing significant staff turnover in who reports these data every year. And this results in districts constantly needing to train and retrain staff just to complete this annual data submission. So four very, very steep challenges indeed. Another thing that we have found is districts are largely reporting students at risk status rather than their proficiency. At risk identification is needed to drive intervention, which is a critical focus of the law. But in 2011, the law changed. It asked districts to identify if students are reading at grade level. So there is a question as to whether districts are assessing proficiency or only identifying students who are at risk. So finally, there are some efforts underway related to improving reading achievement across our state. And I'd like to share a few of them with you. One thing that we have underway is the Minnesota Standards Portal. This is an online one-stop shop, so to speak, for leadership teams in schools and districts across the state to access information, resources, tools, templates to help them implement Minnesota academic standards in all subject areas. We hope to have the first version of this site ready in late spring, and we'll be using it first to provide assistance with regional centers of excellence staff as they work with priority and focus schools. Another effort that we have underway is the regional centers of excellence working with school leadership teams to improve adaptive assistance, to improve the reading, the capacity to implement the reading standards across the schools and in mathematics. That happens as well, of course. We have a standards-based education rubric that has been developed to help districts understand the various stages of standards implementation and to help them focus their efforts where they're needed most. These are some of the efforts. At the preschool level, the department has developed, as you know, the kindergarten entry profile. That includes a valid and reliable menu of comprehensive assessments that can be used for kindergarten, or rather pre-kindergarten through third grade. And to help districts identify those assessments, there is an early learning assessment tool finder, which also can be found on our website. One component that I'm especially pleased about is that the early childhood indicators of progress were revised, and they were posted in January of this year. Those early learning standards, as many people refer to them as, are directly aligned with the kindergarten academic standards. Another initiative that's underway is really a cluster of initiatives, and that surrounds all our professional development and technical assistance efforts that we have going on in collaboration with many other organizations. One example is the age 3 to grade 3 literacy and MTSS communities of practice, where educators regularly engage with each other using data from their own local communities to figure out how they can address problems together using evidence-based practices. There are a number of professional development collaborations that are going on. Some of them are listed on this slide. And finally, we're excited about the opportunity to apply for the Literacy Education for All Results for the Nation, or as it's called, LEARN Grant, which is being offered from the Every Student Succeeds Act. So the department will be submitting an application for that as well. So at a glance, those are some major findings that we have about student proficiency regarding reading, policies regarding reading achievement, how those policies and standards are being implemented, and some initiatives that are currently underway.
Thank you, Ms. Ani. This was very, very interesting and thorough. And members, the department does have some tremendous links on their website for teachers to use. But what I'm wondering, Ms. Ani, is, you know, during my time in the classroom, we went from outcome-based education, then we went to the profile of learning. And then it seems we got really serious as a state and said, no, we're going to be standards-based, and amen, that's the way we're going to proceed. So I'm sure there's had to be a building of trust among our teachers to believe that we really mean what's in the law about now we are standards-based. So the fact that we changed language arts standards, for example, and implemented them so they would take effect very recently, to what extent do you think that, after we determine we're standards-based, has complicated the progress that we're seeing in reading language arts?
Madam Chair, I think the ongoing changes certainly cause disruption for school districts, but I also think that there is a strong thread of continuity through many of those initiatives. You'll remember that in the early stages of outcome-based education, which happened in our state, the idea was to focus on an outcome or result. And I believe that strongly paved the way for people to understand that the result is the given, the curriculum, instruction, learning environment, support we provide students, these are the variables, the time. So we focus on the result, and that paved the way for a standards-based approach, which is all about us having a statewide consensus on what's most important for students to know and be able to do. So I believe that rather than a series of radical disruptions, I believe it's been more of a evolving path that we've been on, and I think districts now are more standards-focused than they've ever been.
So, Ms. Ani, thank you for that response. To what extent are our teacher preparation programs staying current, though, with some of this as they prepare our teachers for the classroom, because we have many new teachers in the classroom now who should have come out of their teacher prep programs understanding the standards-based approach that Minnesota uses. Do you have any idea, do you have any communication with the teacher prep programs to see whether or not our candidates, our teachers, are getting that base?
Madam Chair, I don't have data to share with you, but anecdotally, I know that all teacher preparation programs cover the idea of standards-based education in depth. I think, you know, there's variability, you know, from one program to the next in terms of quality. Some are better than others, but I think they all are preparing graduates to work within a standards-based education system.
Thank you. We have questions for members. Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm trying to sort out. It seems like we've covered a lot of grounds, and some of them were plans on how to help students, but then we're also talking about how to measure whether or not we are helping students. Is that correct?
Ms. Hani.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and may, if I can...
Representative Pryor, go ahead.
Thank you. Try to clear up my confusion on things. Thank you. And how does... So the English Language Arts Standards, ELA, that's the standards that we're trying to achieve. And then we have the multi-tiered system of supports implementation survey. So that's understanding whether or not those standards are being implemented in the schools. Is that correct?
Ms. Ani.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct. So we have Minnesota English Language Arts Standards, K-12 standards. A subset of those standards are the reading standards.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have multi-tiered systems of support. So a, you know, most districts think of it as a three-tiered model of helping students achieve the standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's the basic core instruction that we see is really a big challenge. We feel there's a lot of need there to improve core classroom instruction. And then there's another tier of interventions and, well, group supports, and then a tier of interventions for the students who struggle most. So it's about implementing, and I'm really just glossing over multi-tiered systems of support, but it's about having a range of supports and supporting educators with data-driven decision-making
mm-hmm.
as they meet their students' needs to implement those standards.
Mm-hmm.
So that report covers both. It covers the implementation of standards within a multi-tiered systems.
Mm-hmm. And then the system of support. This will be it. Last question then is, you know, we started this morning talking about, you know, the report on the world's best workforce. Do we see this percolating up into the final data that we're comparing schools' progress on?
Ms. Ani.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes. In fact, ReadWell is a component of the world's, each district's world's best workforce plan.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have kind of a comment and a question in this. I like to start at the very beginning. So I'm concerned about ECFE and how we are not doing as much ECFE as perhaps we have in the past. And thinking about empowering parents with the information and tools that they need for lasting consequences for their children to be successful in school and throughout their lives. And I'm referring specifically to studies that go back to 1995 about the number of words that children hear, and specifically are child-directed from their parents, and understanding that socioeconomic factors don't necessarily correlate with that, but that parents don't seem to know that they need to talk to their children, talk with their children from the earliest ages, so that by the age of two, children who are deprived of words are at least 6 months behind their peers. So given that, is there any effort in this work for that this department is doing to increase reading capabilities, to look at the earliest children and their parents to develop the skills that they need in order to be really successful and ready for school?
Ms. Ani.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, there are a number of initiatives underway. I would defer to Bobby Burnham, who is our Director of Early Learning Services, to share those initiatives in greater detail with you. But that parent engagement, parent awareness, and so on carries through with some of the K-12 initiatives as well, as it is part of the, you know, part of the requirements for Read Well by third grade.
Thank you.
And members, the department, in collaboration with Human Services and Health, those two departments, has produced the Every Day is a Great Day for Your Child to Learn 0 to 3. And it's a very good document that outlines much of what you were talking about, Representative Ward, but it has to be followed. I guess it has to be introduced to the parents and then followed. And it's amazing what it spells out is going to help a child learn words, as you're talking about, Representative Ward, but also all the other things that get them really engaged as a little one. So this is a great document. I think you should take a look at it. Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. I am a library media specialist. I'm also have been a testing coordinator in my district. And my first question is on the slide 21. It says some assessments are being used for purposes that the publishers do not claim are valid, diagnostic or progress monitoring, for instance. And you mentioned MAP testing. Are MAP test scores not to be used to measure progress over the year?
Ms. Ani. Madam Chair, Representative, that's not the purpose for which that test was designed. And I'd like to defer to Corey Stye, our reading specialist, for added detail. Mr. Stye, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chair. Representative, progress can be defined in a couple of ways. And when we refer to whether or not an assessment should be used for progress monitoring, that is a specific use of assessment, which is separate from the general term of use to monitor progress. So an assessment like MAP is most definitely, as a screener, used to monitor progress over time and look at trends and can be administered up to 3 times a year and considered valid as a measurement in that given timeline. When we refer to progress monitoring as an aspect of a district or school's comprehensive assessment plan, progress monitoring is a much more frequent monitoring that's usually in the more like 1 to 2 week range of assessment, specifically to monitor students' response to a specific intervention or specific instruction for that. So assessments are generally considered to do one or more of several purposes, screening being sort of that thermometer check, if you will, of overall reading health to indicate whether or not there's concern and additional assessment should be used. Diagnostic, which is designed to get to the root causes of problems and identify specific issues to be attended to. And then progress monitoring, which is the monitoring over time in short periods to see that the course of action prescribed for a child in response to a deficit is in fact having the intended consequences and to inform changes in that.
Representative?
So I'm just trying to formulate a question here, and mostly it is around the amount of testing that students are, teachers are required to put their students through and the students are supposed to take it. So I understand standard-based education. It's wonderful. And then there's the responsibility of data collection. Is there any kind of a formula or a suggested amount of how often, how many minutes, how much testing we should be in order to collect this data? Because from my, you know, from my viewpoint, there's so much testing. There's all this pre-assessment, post-assessment, focus on the reading, but not necessarily the enjoyment of reading or reading for self-information. And I think part of that is because of the amount of testing that goes into a regular school day. And so I wonder if you would just address, is there best practices as far as how much time a student should be set into testing?
Mr. Stye or Ms. Bonney?
I'll defer to Corey to talk about that relative to reading.
So one of the reasons that we mentioned a multi-tiered system of support is the idea that given those tiers, your first tier of intervention is really that provided to all students. And so all students begin with some kind of a screening assessment. And I would say that based on the data that's provided from schools about what they're doing in K-2 settings through the Read Well by Third Grade data and plan submissions, that almost all districts are using one of about 6 or 7 different commercially adopted assessments in order to do that screening. So in order to answer the question of how many minutes and how much time students are assessed, it really plays into the question of how much additional assessment is needed from that initial screening to get down to the roots of issues. And so for a student who is identified on a screener as being at risk, one would hope that would kick into another level of scrutiny, if you will, that may or may not include specific assessment. It may include communicating with teachers and parents and other information gathering systems. One would hope we would use diagnostic assessments that are specifically designed to determine what students' strengths and weaknesses are so that we can attend to the strengths and capitalize and build upon their strengths. If given that and the instructions prescribed, we're not having the same kind of a impact that we would like, then that kicks in additional, more frequent assessment to see that we can find the appropriate intervention that's going to move the needle and close the gap for that student towards proficiency. So unfortunately, the short answer is there's not a specific guideline or a specific number of minutes per se for students, because it's very determined by those students' needs and the results of the information that districts give. I would say that I think we see, I see in looking at some of the plans, there are some instances in which districts may be gathering the same information in more than one assessment. Mm-hmm. And so the plans themselves may have gaps or they may have redundancies. And so districts may have opportunities to really do an analysis of their comprehensive assessment plan to determine both of those areas and sometimes make improvements on how much time they're spending to gather information. And two, data is only as useful as the decisions that we make from it. And so to not gather data we're not using for decision making is also an important message for us to give our districts.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ani and Mr. Stye, and all those who came from the department to lend us so much information this morning. We'll continue to digest this, and we'll probably have you back. Thank you very much again. Members, the meeting is adjourned.